This message comes from NPR sponsor Osea. Their Mega Moisture Duo features two of their clean, vegan bestsellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Carvana. Selling your car? Visit Carvana and enter your license plate or VIN. Answer a few quick questions and you can get a real offer in seconds. When you finalize your offer, Carvana will pick it up so you never have to leave the comfort of home. Visit Carvana.com or download the app.
This podcast is a production of Nuanced Tales in partnership with WFAE, distributed by the NPR Network. It contains some descriptions or sounds of violence. Listener discretion advised.
But we'll stand. God's people have had to stand and be persecuted from the very beginning.
A pastor shouted.
And we'll continue to protest for Jesus Christ.
Parents picketed.
It's a moral issue and it's a spiritual issue.
Trucks honked. Workers went on strike.
Many coal mines were closed.
Mothers sang. A community was torn by outrage. This was Kanawha County, West Virginia, 1974. The conflict was over new textbooks.
There's things that I don't want my child to know, and when it gets ready, I'll teach it.
The books contained profanity, mentioned sex, and quoted Malcolm X.
The argument by parents over their children's school books has caused demonstrations, beatings, closings of schools, bombings.
Second day in a row, snipers fired at a school bus as a controversy over textbooks in public schools there continued.
Protests and violence in Kanawha County went on for months. Local high school students said they thought the conflict was about whether they would read black authors. The Ku Klux Klan arrived and burned crosses. And a group of outsiders flew in to aid the protesters. A D.C. lawyer from a new think tank called the Heritage Foundation. A Californian representing what was ostensibly an anti-pornography group.
Who elects the school board?
We
are! And who pays for the textbooks?
Yeah.
Then let's hear a little cheer for parent power! Yeah.
Soon, in a nondescript office building outside Washington, D.C., a printer buzzed. Out came a letter. Parents around the country found it in their mailboxes. Your taxes are being used to pay for grade school courses that teach our children that cannibalism, wife swapping, and murder of infants are acceptable behavior. Up in Boston, a bottle shattered. Protesters shoved. Children on school buses flinched.
And they were throwing eggs at the window and trying to hit people with them.
White parents had erupted against a plan to integrate schools. It involved busing children, sometimes across town.
Let us go to our neighborhoods where our kids are safe. We want our kids safe.
Just like in West Virginia, outsiders arrived to help the protesters. They came from organizations with names like the Conservative Caucus, the National Right to Life Committee. Again, in a nondescript office building outside D.C., a printer buzzed. And parents read, "Dear friend, are you as sick and tired of liberal politicians as I am? Force children to be bused," it read. "Force your children to study from school books that are anti-God, anti-American." The letter linked the anti-integration protests and the textbook protests. And then it asked for money. A coalition was coming together.
The belief seemed to be that there was a vast, untapped electorate that would respond to these appeals.
Alan Crawford worked for a new magazine called Conservative Digest. His magazine, the letters, the outside groups, the protests, were all connected. They were like a forest of aspen trees. On the surface, they all looked individual, but they all shared the same DNA. The same names overlapped on their org charts.
So you saw these organizations that were deliberately training young activists and polemicists and publicists, very successful.
Most crucially, nearly all of these groups relied on that nondescript office building outside D.C. Behind a locked door, guarded by multiple security systems, the printer buzzed as computers read millions and millions of names and addresses off of magnetic tape. It was all controlled by Richard Viguerie,
he helped birth a lot of these conservative organizations.
Richard Viguerie, conservative ideologue, direct mail genius.
This was not a secret.
Richard plays a crucial role during that period of political history.
David Keene was a Reagan campaign aide and a director of another right-wing organization, perhaps the largest tree in this forest, the American Conservative Union. Richard Viguerie raised the money. He had mastered collecting and exploiting electronic data. He understood how people who'd supported one cause might give to another, how someone who opposed textbooks might be mobilized to join the fight against busing or abortion. And Keene says Viguerie's letters, with their mentions of anti-God politicians and cannibalism, served a second purpose. They were a new form of media.
You know, now conservatives have talk radio, they have cable news things and all that. There wasn't anything like that back then. The only communications channel that you had directly to conservatives was mail.
Viguerie described his strategy and the strategy of these groups as organizing discontent. In the mid-1970s, these groups and their movement became known as the New Right.
The New Right conservatism.
Richard Viguerie, his organizations under his New Right movement.
The New Right emphasizes a social issue and kind of inflaming passions.
The New Right incited people around the nation who were angry about changes to society and culture. They were building a coalition based on backlash, on grievance, on what today we might call a culture war. And they were doing it with a very clear and explicit goal. The New Right wanted to take over the Republican Party.
The nature of American conservatism was being deliberately changed. They succeeded beyond their wildest dreams.
In the 1976 presidential race, the New Right aligned behind one candidate who shared its goals and values. He could help them win control of the Republican Party, Ronald Reagan. When Reagan announced his 1976 run against Gerald Ford, New Right activists flocked to his campaign as staff and volunteers. But by the spring of 1976, Reagan's bid looked like a failure. He lost five straight primaries. He was on the verge of conceding. This is the story of how it turned around, how the New Right swept in and jolted Reagan's campaign and political career back to life. I'm Ben Bradford, and on this episode of Landslide, one of the most surprising, remarkable, consequential comebacks in American political history. It was driven by that forest of aspen trees, the New Right, and the river of people they would inspire through the politics of grievance.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Sattva. Sattva luxury mattresses are every bit as elegant as the most expensive brands, but because they're sold online, they're about half the price. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR and save an additional $200.
Why is everyone so obsessed with traditional wives or trad wives on social media? This week, we're talking about the viral videos of women making marshmallows and mozzarella from scratch, and how behind the sheen of calm kitchens and cute fits, there's some interesting pessimism about our modern world. And that's worth digging into. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
These days, news comes at you fast. But the truth? Getting there takes time.
There's something that hasn't been disclosed yet.
Embedded is a podcast that takes the time to look beyond the headlines.
How did this happen? How did we get here?
With original documentary storytelling. Listen to NPR's Embedded wherever you get your podcasts. Listen to Embedded for moments that stay with you.
I could smell the smoke. I could smell the dust.
Voices that resonate. Stories that change the way you think about your life.
How did we get here?
The Embedded Podcast is NPR's home for original documentary series. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ronald Reagan fighting to stay alive in the race for the Republican nomination.
He has now lost every one of his head-to-head contests with the president.
And no matter what Reagan does, Ford has been one step ahead.
Reagan lost and lost. Five primaries in a row. It looked over. His campaign manager quietly called a meeting with Ford's to discuss conceding. There was no choice. Frank Donatelli, an outside advisor, says the campaign was broke.
The campaign was badly underfunded. I mean, virtually no money available.
It's important to understand the reason why, because it sets the stage. They'd poured everything into trying to beat Ford early. But it wasn't just that. A new campaign finance law had just gone into effect for this election, 1976, and it radically changed how campaigns raise money, and has ever since.
And it created a Federal Election Commission and a wide range of changes.
The new law was designed as a reaction to Watergate. It put limits, for the first time, on how much any one individual could contribute.
So the big donors just of years previous in the Nixon campaign could not happen.
In other words, no rich friend could bail Reagan out. Instead, the law created public funding, but that was tied up amid legal wrangling. So the campaign only had one option.
Small donations were the coin of the realm.
But gathering small donations was time-consuming. What would you need? Computers, printers, and lists of names, to a degree the campaign didn't have. So Reagan shuttered offices. He laid off staff, except for a skeleton crew who worked without pay. One more primary, and it would finally be over.
So the next primary up is North Carolina. I mean, this is your last shot. You know, you're throwing the kitchen sink in there. North Carolina is it.
Down in North Carolina, a printer buzzed. Every time Reagan lost a primary, voters in the state found a letter in their mailboxes from the North Carolina Congressional Club, a new right group. Carter Wren was the executive director.
We were basically trying to sow hope that Reagan could win.
Wren says the letters targeted conservative Republicans, told them not to lose heart, that they could make the difference and save Reagan.
By doing those mailings, we kept the campaign afloat, and it was a lifeline to a drowning man.
Behind the mailings, behind the North Carolina Congressional Club, there was an architect, Wren's boss, a cutthroat, pipe-smoking political strategist named Tom Ellis. He was furious about Reagan's losses. And in a way, this story and Reagan's comeback is the story of Tom Ellis. He was regarded as a political mastermind. He had recently helped elect North Carolina's first Republican senator since the 1800s, the firebrand conservative Jesse Helms. Ellis had then founded the Congressional Club. He made contact with that publisher in a nondescript office building outside D.C., Richard Viguerie.
You know, what Viguerie had was a database, a massive list of people who were conservative who gave money.
From Viguerie, Ellis learned the value of direct mail. He grew the Congressional Club into one of the largest trees in the New Rights Forest. At one point, it would become the single most powerful independent fundraiser in American politics. And Ellis used the club for one purpose, to back conservative candidates and their causes.
Tom Ellis was all about ideology.
Carter Wren describes him as an anti-communist.
Communism was really the opposite of everything Tom Ellis believed in.
And yet, let's be clear about who Ellis really was, because he saw communism encroaching not just from the Soviet Union, but from government spending, from social movements, and especially from civil rights. Pictures of Confederate generals hung along his office walls. It came out later that Ellis was a director of a eugenicist group with ties to Nazi Germany. When Reagan announced his run for president against Ford, Ellis jumped to help. Reagan named him his top coordinator in North Carolina. But then, Ellis grew frustrated as Reagan lost and lost. He watched the campaign blowing it, and he knew why. It was boring, with Reagan talking about the deficit.
With such a savings, it would be possible to balance the federal budget.
Refusing to go after Gerald Ford.
Reagan repeated his hope that there would be no bitterness engendered in the campaign.
His ads were boring, intentionally. His aides wanted to repackage the political firebrand, the Hollywood actor, as a reasonable, steady administrator.
Our need is for a government that is confident not of what it can do for the people, but of what the people can do for themselves.
Even the applause sounded bored. Ellis had told Reagan's aides for months this strategy was no good. They'd ignored him. And what had it gotten them? 5 losses. But now, the North Carolina primary loomed, and Ellis and his congressional club had something that Reagan's broke campaign desperately needed. The ability to raise a lot of money quickly from small donations. That gave him leverage. Tom Ellis called Reagan's top strategists to a meeting. He had a message for them. Get out.
Mr. Ellis said, well, you get on the plane and fly home. We're going to do what we want to from now on.
The Congressional Club was going to fund the campaign, but there was going to be a new leader in charge of strategy.
Tom Ellis just took control of that campaign. There was nothing they could do. He was going to do what he wanted to do. We were raising the money that paid for it.
He canceled all of the ads the campaign had scheduled for North Carolina. He didn't want boring or steady or reasonable. He wanted vintage Reagan.
Somewhere a perversion has taken place.
Tom Ellis walked into my office one day and he dropped, you know, they used to put movie reels in these old cardboard boxes.
Our natural unalienable rights are now considered to be a dispensation of government.
And what was in that box was the video of Reagan in 1964, given a TV talk for Goldwater.
And freedom has never been so fragile, so close to slipping from our grasp as it is at this moment.
It was the speech that first made conservatives love Reagan. This was the candidate and message Ellis wanted voters to see.
He said, I want to buy all the 30-minute programs we can.
His staff had to convince Ellis they couldn't just air this broadcast. It was in black and white. Reagan was a dozen years younger, referencing topics from a decade before. They needed a new speech. Ellis told the one Reagan aide he trusted, a former colleague, Charlie Black, to get it.
He said, we need to run this in North Carolina. And I said, you're probably right, but we don't have enough money to do that. Half-hour blocks are too expensive. We just need enough to run 30-second commercials. He was so insistent.
Ellis promised he would raise enough money. All Black needed to do was get the speech. Ronald Reagan's face appeared on televisions around North Carolina. Large, the camera's too close. The makeup on his cheeks is obvious. The curtain behind him is an obnoxious bright blue. This was the new 30-minute ad. And it looked cheap, because it was. But equally obvious was a change in tone. No more steady and boring.
Now, I believe that our nation is in great danger. And that danger grows greater with each passing day.
Reagan was here to light a fire.
The sinister forces of totalitarianism are again on the march, while the democracies are wandering without aim.
Instead of talking dollars and cents, Reagan warns of encroaching communism, and he goes after Ford, pointedly, even if he doesn't say his name.
Wandering without aim. I believe that describes the United States foreign policy.
Reagan said to viewers, you are less safe because of Ford, and the America you grew up in has degraded, losing standing to the Soviets.
This nation has become number two in military power in a world where it is dangerous, if not fatal, to be second best.
It was a tenuous argument based on a raw headcount of soldiers and tanks. But when the ad finished playing, Carter Wren remembers the response.
The phone lines exploded. I mean, people started calling in and they wanted to know, when is it going to air again and how can I volunteer? I never saw anything like that in politics.
The Reagan campaign had its first breakthrough.
It was just an eruption.
Ellis sensed momentum. He emptied what was left in the campaign's war chest to buy more TV time and replay the ad. Over and over it ran.
The sinister forces of totalitarianism. I believe that our nation is a great march.
Sometimes at 3 o'clock in the morning, sometimes in the afternoon between the soap operas, but we ran that thing
it is fate.
A couple hundred times.
Danger.
On the campaign trail, Reagan's stump speech changed. It mirrored the ad.
This nation is
become number two in military power in a world where it's dangerous, if not fatal, to be second best.
For the first time, he went after Ford by name, even adding to the old suspicion the president just wasn't smart enough for the job.
Despite Mr. Ford's evident decency, honor, and patriotism, he has shown neither the vision nor the leadership necessary to halt and reverse the diplomatic and military decline of the United States.
As Reagan committed to this line of attack, America is number two. His poll numbers began to tick up. But why? Why did these sudden, not especially credible charges about foreign policy stir such an emotional response? Why were they working? Carter Wren's answer is that it was the height of the Cold War.
Ellis saw, and what he and our pollster, Arthur Finkelstein, both locked eyes on, there's a river of people, and they're worried about losing the Cold War, and that river's big enough to elect Reagan. And Arthur and Tom Ellis ran the whole campaign based on that idea.
Carter Wren just argued that Reagan's new message, America is number two, resonated with a river of people who feared losing the Cold War. I don't think that's true. I think the evidence shows that Reagan was tapping into something baser, angrier, and with major implications for how political campaigns speak to voters today. You've already heard the river of people his message found earlier this episode, roaring against integration in Boston, against textbooks in West Virginia. These were the voters now being roused by Reagan. You could see their overlap at his rallies in North Carolina. While speakers on stage talked of losing the Cold War, Tom Ellis had staff distribute a flyer into the crowds.
It got a huge, good, positive reception, and it hurt Ford, I suspect.
This flyer, that was so well received, suggested that Ford would choose as his running mate a specific liberal Republican senator, the only black senator.
Yeah, it was a lot of Southern politics involved into that, and it was racial.
Reporters confronted Reagan, and he ordered the racist flyer scrapped. But the point is clear. Since his very first run for governor, Reagan had always been a candidate of backlash, a culture war candidate who stood against social change under the banner of anti-communism and government distrust. America's number two was the latest rallying cry, targeting the same people upset by new social movements, cultural change, civil rights. Because it was not about sober foreign policy. It was about backlash, and that was what united the river of people. They were the river of the new right. If that sounds far-fetched, let me tell you about one line that, as Reagan honed his message, gained increasing importance. He mentioned it in his 30-minute commercial.
What are the quiet, almost secret negotiations we're engaged in to give away the Panama Canal?
Reagan kept talking about the Panama Canal.
Reagan's criticism has often been coupled with warnings against any move to, quote, give away the Panama Canal.
The Panama Canal zone is sovereign United States territory, just as much as Alaska is.
This was absolutely not true. The U.S. did not own the canal zone. You didn't become a citizen by being born there. But more importantly, the Panama Canal had not been something on most voters' minds. It was an obscure issue when Reagan began mentioning it. See, back at the turn of the century, in a more colonial era, the U.S. had imposed on Panama a lopsided treaty. The U.S. would finish the canal and control it and the land around it.
634 square miles is surrounded by barbed wire top fence. Its 40,000 American residents enjoy a suburban lifestyle.
For decades, Panamanians' resentment had grown while Americans worked the canal's lucrative jobs.
You can remember what the United States did to get rid of England when you were a colony of England. And right now, part of our country is a colony of yours.
Several past presidents from both parties had sought a peaceful transition. The U.S. interest lay in keeping trade moving through the canal. Getting out of Panama, avoiding riots, violence, and a shutdown was considered unequivocally the best option. But Reagan charged this was a giveaway. The U.S. was caving to Panama's leftist dictator, Omar Torrijos.
When it comes to the canal, We bought it. We paid for it. It's ours. And we should tell Torrijos and company that we're going to keep it.
And as he repeated this charge,
we bought it, we paid for it.
His listeners responded.
And we intend to keep it.
Reagan always gets a big round of applause when he tells audiences that the United States should tell the Panamanian government that this country intends to keep the canal.
Here was the roar of the river of people again. And even Reagan's aides acknowledged that this issue had no bearing on the Cold War.
The Panama Canal issue, it was not about the Panama Canal. I mean, who knew anything about friggin' Panama?
David Keene says the canal was a symbol.
So when Reagan said, we built it, we bought it, you know, it's ours, they said, by God, he's right. And it became sort of a surrogate for every complaint that the public had about the foreign policy establishment.
It was more backlash. It was nationalism. It was a rejection of the idea that the country should have to change in any way. And that was what Reagan was standing for. That's what the River of People found so appealing. And that's what America's number two symbolized. Anger against change. At the end of his 30-minute commercial in North Carolina, Reagan told a story. A little girl, he said, asked him why he wanted to be president.
I tried to tell her I wanted to reduce the power of the federal bureaucracy, to return authority and autonomy to state and local governments. Of course, the little girl couldn't understand that answer, and it wasn't until later that I thought of what the answer should have been. I would like to go to Washington because I would like very much to see this country become once again, for that little girl, the kind of country, the free country that you and I grew up in.
Both President Ford and Ronald Reagan campaigned today in North Carolina, which holds its primary Tuesday. President Ford sounded downright casual, predicting, quote, nothing but victory ahead of him.
As primary day neared, Reagan had made gains. The new strategy of hammering America's number two and the Panama Canal was working. But both campaigns knew Ford was still ahead.
We had done a lot of work, spent a lot of money, done a lot of things, and, you know, we sort of felt like we knew how to win. But we thought that after losing those five primaries, we were probably, at the end of the day, going to lose.
And a Reagan loss, no matter how close, would spell the end.
His plan was he was flying back to California and going to write a withdrawal speech. So that was where it all was.
Think about the implications. Six straight primary losses and an embarrassing exit. It likely spells the end of Reagan's national political career. No two-term President Reagan. Who can tell what politics would look like? That humiliating exit was what both campaigns expected. It seemed like that was what would happen. Except, a printer buzzed. The American Conservative Union, the biggest tree in the New Right Forest, launched a last-minute blitz to give Reagan a final boost. In the closing days of the North Carolina race, the ACU ran newspaper ads. They attacked Gerald Ford for appointing radical liberals, for giving away the Panama Canal. TV ads and hundreds of radio spots reiterated this message. The fact that an outside group could do this so effectively was new. It was the other important result of that new campaign finance law, the one that had hamstrung Reagan's official campaign. The rules, remember, limited how much donors could give. But the Supreme Court had struck down another section. It had removed any limit on what outside groups could spend.
So individuals are now free to spend as much as they wish privately as long as they're not in cahoots with a candidate.
Campaigns had limits. Outside groups did not. The New Right had the means to spend with their printers and lists of names. In North Carolina, the American Conservative Union spent some of the first droplets in what's now our flood of outside spending to keep Reagan in the race. On primary night,
Ronald Reagan turned into a slugger with a punch. Reagan with 52% of the vote.
Reagan earned his first win, and it was not especially close.
The North Carolina primary was like an atomic bomb.
David Keene says the North Carolina win changed the tone of the race.
And it blew out this image of Reagan. This guy was not a joke, that even when Ford looked like he was on the verge of winning everything, Reagan could slap him down.
It sent the Ford camp reeling, White House staff assistant Greg Willard recalls.
It wasn't a whooping, but I mean, it wasn't a squeaker. It was, what the hell just happened?
We expected to win. We didn't. And I might say that in politics, it's never good to come in second.
Beating Ford didn't solve Reagan's fundamental problems, the chronic lack of money or being behind in the delegate count, which decides the nomination. But it marked a turning point. It resuscitated his dying campaign. And most importantly, after North Carolina, Reagan had a clear blueprint provided by Tom Ellis of how to win.
The economy right now is bewildering, impenetrable, inconceivable.
Not when you have the indicator of our guys in your ears. In under 10 minutes every day, we simplify the complicated news, like...
How does inflation drop? What the heck is a SPAC? Why are trendy little high-fiber sodas suddenly dominating store shelves?
And more. Listen to the indicator from Planet Money and NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Why did Cola Scola write a bonkers, extremely fictionalized play about Mary Todd Lincoln?
Well, you know, it was 2020 and we were all so isolated. I just started doing research. But the truth is, I just thought of it.
We'll talk about that and more on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
There are a lot of issues on voters' minds right now. Six big ones could help decide the election. Guns, reproductive rights, immigration, the economy, healthcare, and the wars overseas. On the Consider This podcast from NPR, we will unpack the debates on these issues and what's at stake. You can listen to NPR's Consider This wherever you get your podcasts.
When the economic news gets to be a bit much.
Listen to The Indicator from Planet Money. We're here for you, like your friends, trying to figure out all the most confusing parts. One story, one idea, every day, all in 10 minutes or less.
The Indicator from Planet Money, your friendly economic sidekick.
From NPR.
Reagan turned his attention to the largest primary so far, Texas. Texas had 100 delegates up for grabs, a huge haul. It could change the complexion of the race. He needed a strong showing. Reagan quickly adopted all of the tactics that had worked so well in North Carolina. His face once again appeared on TVs around the country, but not too zoomed in this time. His makeup not as obvious.
Good evening to all of you from California.
This was a new 30-minute ad with better production values, but almost exactly the same script as he'd used in North Carolina.
We're number two in a world where it's dangerous, if not fatal, to be second best.
The Panama Canal.
We bought it. We paid for it. We built it.
The story of the little girl.
She said, "Why do you want to be president?"
The phone lines, once again, exploded. And this time, donations rained down from across the country.
I remember the bags of mail.
Becky Black was receptionist at the campaign's headquarters.
Just the bags of mail that came in afterwards. They took to weighing the bags and telling the bank, you know, 30 pounds of mail came in today.
Meanwhile, the printers kept buzzing. The American Conservative Union upped its spending, and it was joined by other trees from the forest, fund for a conservative majority, college students for Reagan. Ford's press secretary expressed alarm as he realized the amounts pouring in on Reagan's behalf.
Outside groups, he said, have been buying as much as 80% of the political advertising for Reagan.
On the campaign trail, Reagan narrowed his focus more and more to one issue.
We are indeed negotiating a giveaway of the Panama Canal Zone and Canal, and under orders signed by President Ford.
The Panama Canal grew to be the central issue of the 1976 Republican primaries.
Reagan said he would risk guerrilla war rather than negotiate the return of the canal to Panama.
Ford couldn't believe this had become a campaign issue, much less such a big one. He tried to spell out the consequences of what Reagan was suggesting.
We'll have to send at least another 10 and probably 20,000 more Americans down there. We can avoid all of that by continuing the negotiations for a responsible settlement. and those who advocate breaking off negotiations are irresponsible.
I remember frustration. How can this be, you know, that this thing can now become a campaign issue?
Fort's personal assistant, Terry O'Donnell.
It took on a proportion well beyond itself. I mean, it was because it touched upon a little bit of what we now think of as America First.
Let me ask you what the national policy should be. Should it be that any time any country, no matter how small, wants to threaten us with rioting and bloodshed, that the United States gives up whatever is demanded of it?
Reagan adopted a new slogan, Make America Number One Again. The river of people continued to swell. Texas, along with some other upcoming states, held an open primary, so Democrats and independents could cross over and vote in the Republican race. Reagan saw a tributary waiting to be tapped. He reached out to supporters of his closest analog in the Democratic Party.
How can you be too strong on segregation?
The segregationist George Wallace.
The matter of law and order.
They even say you can't pray in a public school anymore.
George Wallace had been the top vote-getter in the Democratic primaries 4 years earlier, until he was shot and paralyzed while campaigning. A return this year had fizzled, fallen flat. Wallace was out. In Texas, Reagan reached out to his crestfallen supporters.
If they feel that they can achieve more of what they want by supporting me, that'd be fine with me.
His campaign ran ads featuring Wallace voters who testified about their support for Reagan. He distributed flyers. This year, it's okay to vote for a Republican.
The appeal is beginning to pay off. At a rally in Fort Worth today, Reagan announced that two groups of former Wallace supporters have now decided to support him.
Meanwhile, Gerald Ford was campaigning too, for Republican votes. While Reagan harped on the Panama Canal, Ford emphasized the improving economy, decreasing unemployment, how he was dependable and reliable. And he felt confident. National polls showed him well ahead within his party.
Gerald Ford has a commanding lead over Ronald Reagan, his opponent in the primaries. Among Republicans, Ford leads Reagan 53% to 35%, an 18-point lead.
So Ford poured money into Texas. He campaigned aggressively. He wanted to deliver the knockout.
We committed a lot of money we shouldn't have committed there. I think we spent about $1 million in Texas.
Pollster Bob Teeter was still disgusted years later.
Everything was bad about it, and starting with the polling. It was one of the great polling disasters.
It was a lovely day in Texas, with weather in the low 70s. Voters waited in lines that snaked from polling sites across the state. And the result of that primary day upended the race.
In the Texas primary, Reagan wiped out the president in a stunning victory.
We got beat 100-0, literally 100-0.
We beat him 100 delegates to zero. We swept the state every congressional district, and it was a huge win.
In an instant, Reagan had all but caught up to Ford in the race. Because, as a local paper announced, Democrats had gone wild for Reagan.
All those Wallace Democrats coming over and vote in the Republican primary, it just created a tidal wave.
The river of people carried Ronald Reagan to a massive victory on a raft built from grievance, backlash, and the trees of the new right. He had united Democrats and Republicans into a winning conservative coalition. President Gerald Ford was up on stage giving a speech in Washington when his aide Terry O'Donnell slipped him the results of Texas.
And I took the note up to the president who was on the dais at the time. And, you know, you could see his shock.
The news only got worse for Ford. In the next primaries, Reagan continued the strategy that had worked so well in Texas, talking about the Panama Canal, courting Wallace Democrats. The river of people kept sweeping him to victories.
Today it is Reagan who is doing the smiling, because in the last 4 days he may have turned it around.
Reagan won four primaries in 4 days, beginning with Texas last Saturday,
Georgia, Alabama, and a big win in Indiana.
Printers buzzed. The new right continued its blitz of outside ads and mailings.
There is frustration at the Ford White House.
There's a frantic, unsigned memo from the Ford campaign. It's amazing to go back and read it now. It notes the turnout Reagan was generating from Republicans and Democrats. It reads, "A clear pattern is emerging. These turnouts now do not seem accidental, but appear to be the result of skillful organization by extreme right-wing political groups in the Reagan camp operating almost invisibly through direct mail." It mentions publisher Richard Viguerie. And then it ends with this conclusion. "We are in real danger of being out-organized by a small number of highly motivated right-wing nuts." Right-wing nuts. The surprise in that memo, the derision from whoever wrote it, it captures so much about that time and what you're hearing in this story. It seemed unbelievable that Ronald Reagan and the new right could win. Yet their organization, outside spending, and ability to inspire a new coalition with their politics of grievance ambushed the establishment. They began to change politics. It wouldn't be long until the so-called right-wing nuts were well within the mainstream. But not yet. For the remainder of the primaries, Ford and Reagan traded wins. The contest grew increasingly bitter.
"Stung by his defeat in Indiana, President Ford today started scrambling for a new strategy to protect him from Ronald Reagan."
Reagan was now the frontrunner. Ford hit back at him, running dire ads about his extremism.
"When you vote Tuesday, remember, Governor Reagan couldn't start a war. President Reagan could."
Ford took Maryland and Michigan. Reagan won in Idaho and Nevada. Ohio went for Ford. California for Reagan. By the time the primaries ended, neither candidate had what they needed for the nomination. Neither had a majority of delegates. That meant the decision of who would be the nominee and who would control the Republican Party would come down to the 1976 Republican National Convention. Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan faced off in what became known as the shootout in Kansas City. That's next time on Landslide. But before that, a brief epilogue regarding the Panama Canal. The canal stayed a hot-button issue in American politics for years. It became the issue for the new right, the single most powerful fundraising topic.
"Together, we can defeat the dangerous U.S.-Panama treaties. Please call Western Union now."
New right spending increased tenfold. Within 4 years, it was the single most significant source of outside spending in U.S. politics. The Senate ultimately did vote on a treaty to hand over operation of the canal to Panama, the responsible course to avoid riots and bloodshed. The night before that vote, David Keene was with another Reagan aide, the person who was the chief early advocate of making the canal a campaign issue. He was worried about what he'd done.
"I remember the night they were voting on the Panama Canal Treaty. We're having dinner, and he said, you don't think they're really going to reject it, do you?" I said, "Don't worry, Pete."
The treaty passed, barely. Then trade continued as normal. None of Reagan's dire warnings materialized, of course. And so the main effect of the Panama Canal issue, which dominated the 1976 primaries, was that the trees of the new right grew thicker and the buzz of the printers ever louder. There's a whole book about the Panama Canal and how it helped reconfigure American politics, Drawing the Line at the Big Ditch by Adam Clymer. You can see the rest of this episode's sources through our show page at wfae.org/landslide. Landslide is a production of Nuanced Tales. It is created, hosted, reported, produced, and written by me, Ben Bradford. Edited by Rick Carr. Engineering and sound design by Jay Siebold. Our music is composed and performed by Matt Bradford. Hannah Luck created the cover art. Landslide is produced in partnership with WFAE. Greg Collard and Eli Portillo provided editorial support and strategic guidance. Web design and marketing support by Jen Lang and Lena Hong. Judon Marshall is the CEO at WFAE. The podcast is distributed by the NPR Network. Thanks to Dan McCoy, Lindsay McKenna, Gary Duong, and the rest of the team at NPR. To see more about Landslide, visit our website at wfae.org/landslide.
Moms know the ups and downs of life. It's what makes them great subjects for books.
This is one of the things that fiction can do, right? It can give us a window into the battles that each person is waging or facing, but it doesn't mean that we condone her actions.
This week on NPR's Book of the Day podcast, we are discussing books centering mothers. So call your mom, then tune into the Book of the Day podcast from NPR.
Hey, I hear you have a birthday coming up. Yeah, you. If you're listening to this, that means you have a birthday coming up eventually. And here at Life Kit, we want it to be a special one.
Magic can happen and good luck can happen and serendipity can happen if we're open to it.
How to have a good birthday, even if you're not a birthday person. That's on the Life Kit podcast from NPR.
Do you ever wish you could get your stories in 3 hours rather than 3 minutes? Or maybe you're sick of doom scrolling, getting your news in bits and pieces. That is where Embedded comes in. We bring you documentary series that will change the way you think about things. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.